commencing countdown.
3, 2, 1.
This is the Contracting Experience. Connecting government contracting professionals to the world around them through conversations with acquisition influencers, insights into evolving hot topics, and sharing lessons learned from the field.
Welcome, podcast listeners. On this episode of The Contracting Experience, we sit down with Mr. Ed Keller, Director of Contracting at the Air Force Rapid Capabilities Office. He is a member of the Senior Executive Service and a certified professional contract manager by the National Contract Management Association. Mr. Keller recently had a feature article published in the March-April 2026 edition of Contract Management Magazine, where he outlines how applying the Rapid Capabilities Office model can drive acquisition flexibility and speed. Welcome, Mr. Keller. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, thanks, Rob. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm sort of looking forward to this. Thank you.
All right. You bet. Thank you, sir. So let's start off by setting the stage for our listeners. So your article uses the Air Force RCO, Rapid Capabilities Office, as a blueprint for success. Can you first explain the mission of the RCO, how you're organized, maybe the unique role you play within the Department of the Air Force?
Of course. The Air Force RCO was created in 2003 because the leadership at the time was, as they are now, dissatisfied with the pace of acquisition and its ability to keep up with the threat. Its mission primarily is to expedite the development and fielding of capabilities to the warfighter. It has a number of other missions to innovate, to push the technical edge, but that is the primary one, to expedite the fielding of capability. And so to do that, they decided to create a chartered organization. And then that charter places the RCO under the direct authority of a board of directors, which is really our most senior leaders, including the secretary, Chief of Staff of the Air Force, Chief of Space Operations, Senior Acquisition Executive. And they built the team following sort of the Skunk Works model from Lockheed Martin back in the day, and which was built on small, agile, flat teams with all the functions they need to be successful. And so that's how the RCO is modeled and built. And so we have a very minimally manned, fully integrated team, in the belief that that drives agility and speed. This also, the reporting to the board of directors and also access to leadership is a key part of this too, where we have regular engagements with the secretary, with both chiefs, with all of our senior leaders, now the DRPMs, the direct reporting program manager, to execute our programs. And its mission is to, for selected capabilities that can be fielded, say, within 3 to 5 years, to take existing and mature technologies, combine them into militarily useful capabilities, and get something fielded quickly. There are exceptions to that. The B-21 is one exception to that. But that's our bread and butter, are the things that you can deliver and to the warfighter within a relatively short period of time. And I will say a secondary mission, which I mentioned in the article, is to serve as a model for the rest of the Air Force and the rest of the Department of War, which is what the executive order pushes us to do, so that we learn from these sorts of environments and apply them more broadly.
All right. Excellent, sir. Yeah, that direct line to leadership definitely sounds like a game changer there. And you alluded to it. You're right. Your recent article is actually in response to that 2025 executive order for modernizing defense acquisitions and spurring innovation in the defense industrial base. So in your analysis, what do you see as the single greatest obstacle for DOD in facing or implementing the EO's mandate for accelerated procurement across the entire enterprise?
I would say when I look across, when you look to scale what the RCO does, You know, some of it's not scalable. The direct access is probably not scalable. Things like that, a selected workforce is not necessarily scalable. But one of the things that I think is that if we took a look at the vertical organizational structures that are common in many of our acquisition centers, highly vertical organizations, and what I mean by that are multiple layers, they're just simply slower to respond because everyone in that vertical chain feels compelled to weigh in and input into the process. And at some point, you pass a point where that really provides a lot of benefit. And all of it takes time and drives process time. At the RCO, we're much flatter. For instance, I'll use contracting as an example. In contracting, if you're a PCO in the RCO, the only person between you and me is your COCO. And then I work for the Tier 3 SES. And so you cut down and it's much flatter. And if your COCO's not around, then you're going to come see me directly. And so that access to leadership and maintaining that flat nature is part of what I think needs to be done. The authorities and the delegations of authorities are all great, but that doesn't matter if there are so many levels and layers to work through that it still takes so much time. Our thresholds at the RCO are very much like they are in other places. But I think one of the big differences, at least in contracting, is that flat structure. And I think that's something that leadership should really take a look at, to put more people executing and fewer people reviewing those that are executing.
Yes, sir. That absolutely makes a lot of sense. And building on that cultural point, so you champion the RCO's culture of trust and risk tolerance as a key to its success. How can the broader DoD, which is now required to operate under this new EO framework, realistically replicate this culture outside of, as you mentioned, a specialized, hand-picked organization?
Right. I think culture, is a lot of that can be scaled to these larger organizations. First of all, I think it starts with leadership. Leadership has to lean into this, and they have to change their own behavior. And I'll tell you what I mean here. So there is a strong cultural aversion in a lot of programs, in a lot of places. And there is a lot of, as things make their way to leadership, there's a lot of reviews and a lot of people polishing the apple to avoid ambiguity with senior leaders, to avoid giving them products that aren't 100% polished and beautiful. And I think that takes a lot of time. When we do things at the RCO, we don't do pre-briefs. We don't, a lot of times the senior leaders, including myself and my boss, will review things that aren't quite 100%. They'll get vectors and then give the subordinates wide discretion from those vectors to go off and operate and not keep coming back to get things perfect. That requires leaders to be willing to operate that way. And then that discretion and that latitude where your teams are going to go out and operate and make decisions, sometimes they're going to mess things up. And you have to be willing to sort of go with that and not crush them, but to make adjustments and dust them off and move them forward if something happens. But you want them to make decisions quickly and make them in a way that they feel empowered, that you're not going to come back and crush them or reverse them later on. One thing that we try to do also is make sure that the process does not wait for anybody. If the whole chain of command is not there when they need to go see a senior leader, then it goes anyway in most cases. And one of my favorite examples is it was a Friday or something, but anyway, the team ended up in front of Mr. Hunter, who was the senior acquisition executive at the time, and the only contracting person in the room was one of our mid-grade captains, because none of us were available, he took it in, he answered all the questions, and he came back out of there, and everything was fine. And so you have to be kind of willing to do that and let people get in front of leaders and trust that they're going to make the right decision. On the technical side, I would say, to broaden this out a little bit, it manifests itself in being more comfortable with concurrency risk. And so what you'll see sometimes in RCO programs is a little bit more program concurrency between the different events that happen through, say, an EMD program. There's risk there, but it really is necessary to sort of drive speed and make a decision about, okay, can we take the lessons at an earlier stage, go ahead and move out on the next stage without waiting for it to play completely out. And so that's another way that I think we can increase the risk tolerance and maybe drive process speed.
Yeah, right. So no, those are all great points there. That's phenomenal. And then the executive order effectively demands more RCO-like agility across the enterprise, right? So by creating this kind of elite empowered workforce that you talk about, it could present its own challenges. So as you train people to be highly autonomous and effective, how do you address the retention problem and keep these star performers from being lured away into maybe the private sector or another organization?
Well, I think, you know, we have a lot to offer our contracting officers. And some of the things that we offer them are leadership opportunities, development opportunities, but most of all, it's the mission. You know, the thing that keeps people in the RCO and keeps people in all these places, really, is their association with the mission. I myself have gone to industry, and I came back because of the mission. I wanted to own that mission, be part of that. And also, that development piece, I think, is very important, that nowhere are they going to put as much emphasis on making sure that people get the professional and career development that they will within the government. I've had people come back from industry, back into the RCO, because they miss all the things I just mentioned. They want that. At the same time, I don't think that our organization should be built solely on a model of retention. You know, we should be built on a model of where are we going to do when people are with us? And then where are they going to go when they leave us? Now, I would much prefer they stay within the government, but I don't try to keep everybody here. We have a workforce that comes in. They achieve their career goals that they're trying to achieve. We need to know what those things are, and then we need to help set them up for success. And then that will drive its own, if not retention, it'll attract new talent and new people to come in and keep it an attractive place to work. And I think that keeping it dynamic like that is the way to go, particularly in a time where we demand innovation. But again, I think the things that really drive people to stay with the government, stay with the Air Force, is its mission and the commitment to a career plan that will fully develop people throughout their working lives.
No, so that makes absolutely perfect sense. And that reminds me of a quote from Richard Branson, right? Founder of Virgin Group, Virgin Airlines. He said, train your people so they can leave, but treat them well enough so they never want to. So good stuff there. And I like the way you phrase it. The mission itself becomes the ultimate retention incentive. So that's great. And let's shift a little bit from people to process. So this executive order clearly prioritizes speed. And your article highlights the RCO's ability to move fast while achieving savings. So as this model is scaled, how does a leader balance the EO's demand for speed against the ever-present pressure for compliance and fiscal discipline?
Well, that's a really great question. You know, speed with discipline is our vision in RCO contracting. Now, I stole that vision because I really liked it, but I also think it fits what we're trying to do. Any organization and team can go fast if they're undisciplined. There's no skill or competence in that. True professionals can rapidly deliver while remaining compliant. And that comes down to the fundamentals of running a solid contracting organization, self-inspection programs, messaging, enforcement. And it also comes down to highly competent skilled workforce, which we just talked about, development. I still think that our contracting officers are the best trained in the government and really in the entire contracting workforce across government and industry. And so those are big parts of it to ensure you maintain that compliance. More strategically, I believe we need to protect the PCO's unique authorities and relative independence during the acquisition transformation effort. I really support acquisition transformation. The alignment to the portfolio acquisition executives is really good. And it aligns actually with the way the RCO has been operating all these years. I work directly for the PEO and the contracting people work for me, but we are all aligned under the PEO and in pursuit of that portfolio. We're not matrixed in that regard. But the organizational structures as this gets expanded must preserve free exchange and constructive conflict. I fundamentally believe that we need to set these structures up so that there is an avenue for contracting officers to exercise their authority and give unbiased, clear advice to the program manager. And I don't think that that really works if that program manager is their boss. It really works best if they're teammates and partners, but that contracting officer has an escape hatch if they need it, so that they feel free to give that unbiased and clear advice that their authorities demand and that I think drives a much better, more compliant process.
All right. So yeah, absolutely. Again, making perfect sense along the whole conversation here. The executive order also pushes for rapid prototyping. So based on the RCO's experience, what is your primary recommendation for ensuring these new EO-driven projects don't fall into this infamous valley of death, right, between development and full-scale fielding? How do we do that rapid prototyping?
Well, I'll tell you, the way that we've learned within the RCO, we're designed to develop prototypes, minimally viable products and transition them to a larger center for full-scale production, operations, and sustainment. And sometimes we do well at that, and sometimes we don't. I think that we have our best success when that transition plan for that initial capability is built in up front. This ensures a more integrated approach. There's less gaps between approaches of the losing and the gaining organizations. And there's more communication throughout so that the gaining organization is aware of everything that's going on and totally plugged in. Now, the B-21 is not a great example of a typical RCO program, but we did that with that program to the point now where 80% of the people who work on B-21 are our lifecycle management center people. The leadership of both the PEO and the contracting activity is RCO, but LCMC has been involved from the very beginning. And therefore, when it comes time to transition that weapon system for full-scale production and sustainment, operations and sustainment to LCMC, it'll be relatively seamless process because they've been there from the very beginning, partnered from the very beginning. So I think that has really been a key part of how we've been successful when we've been successful in making those transitions.
Okay, sir. Again, you're hitting all the right buttons, sir. This is becoming very clear. So, and again, starting with the end in mind, right? Who's that end customer? Get them involved early. All great stuff. So let's pivot a little bit. So far, we've focused heavily on culture and process. The main metric discussed in the context of the EO is, as we discussed, speed, right? So in your opinion, how should the DoD measure the true effectiveness of the capabilities delivered under this new policy to ensure that fast is also effective?
Well, the true effectiveness, you know, as it, we can and should streamline and expedite our acquisition processes. And this is what the EO talks about. This is what a lot of the article was about. And efficiency is important. But in the end, it may save you months. It may save you a year. And for each one of those, that will increase throughput, and that's very important. However, true effectiveness can only be achieved through the on-time delivery of war-winning capabilities. On-time equals militarily relevant. A capability that comes too late is useless. So we need to take care in defining requirements so that they are reasonable and achievable within the required timelines. We need to ensure that we've built in the correct contract structure and incentives and that we are actively managing these programs. In other words, we're not firing for getting. We're going in there and we're actively managing these things throughout the life of the program. But then at the end of the day, we must partner with industry, and industry must deliver. Because if they don't deliver the capability, and again, we have a hand in that, in how we set these requirements up and how we set these source selections up. But at the end of the day, they have to deliver, and they have to perform on these contracts. And so that, to me, is the measure. The measure is delivery of capability. Because we could go fast. And we've seen a lot of programs like this where we've gone fast, but it doesn't, at the end of the day, the contractor is not delivering and not meeting cost, schedule, and performance. And that is really the measure that we need to be focused on.
All right. Excellent, sir. And that actually tied into my next question. I was going to talk about industry, which you call out in your article for, you know, industry really needs to adapt to this new reality created by the executive order. So anything to add on what you already stated? What's the most significant change that you believe is required from industry partners to help the government fully realize the EO's goals?
There was another executive order issued where the president told industry that they needed to put more skin in the game and make more IRAD investments. So what does that mean? That means that they need to work with their Department of War partners, industry does, so that they're more able to skate to the puck. They need a more commercial approach of investing to win. This is a big change for our DIB industry partners who have historically invested less in IRAD and waited more for government funding to come in before they start moving out. But we need them to deliver at speed. And the only way to do that is that they have more mission-ready tech and can respond more quickly. You know, CCA in the Air Force is a great example where we asked for mission-ready technology so that they could deliver a capability much quicker, and then we could prove it out and then move to the next steps. And so we need more of that sort of model rather than these very long development cycles. And so, and then they need, as I said before, they need to perform. And maybe that comes down to how we define requirements so that they're more achievable and so forth, as I said earlier. But at the end of the day, they need to not overpromise, and they need to deliver these capabilities within the timeline so that we can iterate more quickly and meet this mission need that we have. Over.
All right, sir. No, great point there, right? More, you know, and investment dollars up front, have that technology further along when we ask for something. So, yeah, great stuff there. So next transition. So for the thousands of contracting officers now operating under the 2025 executive order, what's the most important piece of advice you can offer them as they navigate the shift from traditional processes to more empowered and an agile mindset?
Well, I think the key to innovation is having the knowledge, skills, and competence to begin with. Those things are the springboard for innovation. So you have to understand the business and be a master of the business to truly innovate. You have to understand what that point of departure is. So I would say, for one thing, know your job. And I know this is shifting sands with the revolutionary FAR overhaul, but the basics are still there, and you need to know what these changes are, keep up with them, and then from there, you'll be able to better innovate and move forward. I think that also involves things that we push all the time in terms of breadth and depth. Having worked in a lot of different places in a lot of different environments, it gives you the tools from all these different arenas that you can use in creative and innovative ways. So if you've worked in installation and enterprise and systems and labs, sometimes you'll go to, you'll cross these different arenas and you'll be able to use tools that you learned along the way, even if it's sort of a new and creative way that maybe they haven't done there before. But that breadth built on that foundation of competence and skill really is the key. I think too, it's important that we build in our workforce that empowerment that they need and their focus on the mission, and that using the FAR, General Holt used to talk about making the FAR sing, knowing that job, but then giving them the freedom to make those changes and move out on those changes of approach. But that's going to require, as I said earlier, leadership, buy-in, and support, because the workforce won't do that if they don't feel like it's supported by their leadership or that their leadership has their back. So we need to train them on these innovative ways. They need to train themselves on them. And then we need to give them freedom to operate and use those skill sets and those tools, and encourage them to integrate with their program managers and technical teams. It is important that they understand the requirements that they're working on. The best contracting officers out there are the ones that understand the missions that they're going after, the objectives they're going after. You don't have to be a technical expert, but you definitely need to understand what it is you're buying and what it is you're doing to be able to give the greatest utility to the team. So that's the other thing. To help them all innovate, the contracting officers got to know what we're working on.
Yeah, great, great stuff, sir. Absolutely. Know what you're working on. And then, it kind of ties back to our earlier discussion on culture, right? Culture, leadership, the buy-in, the empowerment, right? Kind of all feeds in together. So great stuff. And while we're on that, let's shift a little bit to maybe a career focus. So for our listeners who might be intrigued by this fast-paced world of the RCO, what's the single biggest surprise a seasoned contracting professional might encounter if they move into an organization like the RCO?
I think the biggest thing, and I've asked this question to people that have come from other places into the RCO, and they almost always mention the degree of personal accountability and authority that we give them. As I mentioned earlier, very few layers of review. We really focus on product over process. The other way to look at it is chefs, not cooks. We don't really have a lot of step-by-step checklists that people can follow. We're looking for you to look at the problem, apply your professional insights into that problem within the confines of that multifunctional team, and then execute from there. Without always looking for, mother may I's or approvals. Now, this can be unnerving to some. I've had a couple of folks come through that really were more comfortable knowing, okay, these are the steps I'm supposed to follow. But for many, it's exhilarating and freeing to just not have to stop constantly and update and talk and get other people's approvals to do things, that you're basically in your program executing to the problems, and your individual insights and decisions are driving the thing forward. And so I think that's another thing, is that the ability to make major decisions, brief those decisions to senior leaders about what we're doing and moving forward. You're relied on as one of the few PCOs in the room many times. You might be the only PCO on your program. If it's an ACAT 2 or 3 equivalent program, very often we have one PCO that others may help, but they're usually the only one. And so I think that that's very energizing for a lot of people. I think the other thing can sometimes be is the pace. Because we're minimally manned, because we're so flat, and the expectation is that we move quickly, we cut process, your days go by quickly, and it's a very strong pace that takes you through, and you have to be a person that's energized by that pace and coming in and hitting the ground running every day. But I'd say those are the biggest things that you'll see culturally.
All right, great. So yeah, it kind of reminds me of an analogy, ladder climbing versus rock climbing, right? Ladder climbing, you're always comfortable with that next rung. You know, it's always going to be there. It's always going to be steady. Sometimes that rung might not be there, right? But the way you're talking about empowering people, you know, maybe it's more of a rock climbing analogy, right? Maybe they need to deviate along the way. You're still dealing with the same laws of physics, right? You don't want to fall, but sometimes, you're right, maybe that's what you're getting at with that adaptation, empowerment. So good stuff. So, sir, what's the most rewarding part of your job at the RCO? Is there a moment that makes you kind of step back and say, this is exactly why I do what I do?
Yes, I think, you know, there's a couple of things. The trust at all levels is rewarding. You know, everybody likes to be valued, and because we are one deep in a lot of places, the contribution of contracting within the broader framework of the program team, the multifunctional team, is highly appreciated and understood, and so that's really important. Also, I think, you know, I've been there long enough now that I've seen capabilities begin as concepts be delivered and be delivering capability to the warfighter and real progress in the timeline that I've been there. I'll give an example. I can't give the specifics, but we had a space system that when I first came there, I actually came there as a contractor some years ago. And we had a space system that I was involved in the acquisition strategy for the development of this system. And in that time frame, it has been, this system was launched, delivered in orbit, is, you know, sending data, modeling the sorts of technologies that the enterprise wanted to see it do, has been successful. And then we've transitioned it to the Space Systems Command, who's operating it, pulling lessons off of it. And then they're going to take some aspects of its technology and capabilities and concepts and carry that into the next iteration of that mission area, and add that to the follow-on production large-scale contract that they're going to do later on. And so, you know, that's really energizing and a positive thing that you take away from it. I think those are the biggest things, is to see things really happen within a timeline that we can all participate in, rather than it being something you worked on and then 8 years later you hear about it was delivered. So there's two things: trust and that tangible delivery of capability, I think, are the biggest parts of the job that are very rewarding.
All right. Excellent, sir. Again, this is a great conversation. Thanks again for joining us. But before I let you go, I wanted to offer you a chance for any parting shots, anything you might have thought of during the conversation, any drop the mic moment. What do you have left for our listener, sir?
Well, I do think it's important to understand that this executive order and really the acquisition transformation approach that's been directed by the SEC war is a real opportunity to address what is our most pace-setting challenge, which is the strategic competition with near-peer adversaries. And, you know, there's a lot in what is in the EO and in the acquisition transformation order that we've been given that has been studied and looked at for many years. A lot of that came from like the PPBE group that was there a few years ago, other studies that were its predecessor. But this is where we execute on the things that we know we need to do to meet this challenge and to finally commit to speed, empowerment, and changing that risk calculation across the department. I say this many times, you know, the RCO matters little if the big acquisition centers don't adapt, learn from what places like the RCO model and demonstrate, and apply them more broadly across the entire enterprise. RCOs and innovation organizations like it can never deliver at the scale that is needed to meet the formidable challenges that confront us. It has to be enterprise-wide adoption of many of these strategies, techniques, and approaches. That's what the EO focuses on. That's what the SecWars Acquisition Transformation Initiatives focus on. That's what my article highlighted. And so I think those are the things that we really need to lean into to meet these challenges. And then the last thing I'll say, it really will require our leaders to buy into the change for our teams to buy into it. So we have to commit at all levels. It starts with our leadership. And I hope they lean into this across the board so that we can meet the challenges that confront us in this day and age. So thank you.
All right. Excellent, sir. Again, thanks for sharing your experiences and insights on The Contracting Experience. I think you laid out a call for leadership, a call for industry, and a call for our workforce in general. So great, great stuff there. Great conversation. Really glad you could join us, sir. And a shout out to all of our podcast listeners, followers, and subscribers. If you have any feedback, suggestions for topics, or future guests you would like to hear on the podcast, you can submit those via email to thecontractingexperience@gmail.com. As a reminder, you can subscribe to The Contracting Experience podcast from any of your podcast listening platforms. Be sure to subscribe to receive updates and automatic downloads so you don't miss a single episode. I'm your host, Rob Lorton, and I hope you can join us again on our upcoming episodes. Until then, stay tuned and stay connected.